This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we're having a discussion about developing renewable energy projects and opportunity zones. Our panel is Patrick Moran with Dwayne Morris, Rick Brown at Terra Verde Energy, and Michael Walton at Green Spaces Chattanooga. Patrick, why don't you start us off here, telling us a little bit about what's going on.
Sure, Sierra, thank you. So I'm going to start with just a very brief overview of the Opportunity Zone program, a very brief discussion of project financing renewables, and a very brief discussion of how those two may or may not mesh together, and then open it up to the others for discussion. So the Opportunity Zone program was part of the Tax Reform Act at the end of 2017, and it was something that was not highly touted or really noticed right away because it was kind of toward the back of that enormous piece of legislation, but it potentially has a very significant impact. And what it does is it allows the investment of capital gains into low-income census tracts throughout the country with certain incentives or rewards for making those investments. So to take it back one step, the actual opportunity zones themselves are, like I said, they are tracts of land that were determined to be low-income areas in the last census, so the 2010 census. And the governor of every state, as well as the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, were permitted to designate a certain number of those tracts as eligible for participating in the Opportunity Zone program. So that's what the zones are and where they exist. They're throughout, like I said, all jurisdictions in the U.S., and if I'm not mistaken, the entirety of the island of Puerto Rico has been declared an opportunity zone, which can be significant for renewable development. We may or may not discuss throughout this call. So that's what the zones are, where they are, and what the incentives are, or actually, so let's go back one step further, and how money can be invested into these zones is if a qualified opportunity fund is established to make investments either into a business operating in an opportunity zone or investments in land in real estate in the opportunity zone itself. And so the question is, why would somebody invest in a qualified opportunity fund and what are they investing? Is probably the first question to answer. The second is, what are the incentives for doing so? So a qualified opportunity fund comprises realized capital gains within the last 180 days. And those gains, once placed into a qualified opportunity fund, must then be invested into an opportunity zone within 180 days. And like I said, it can be either invested into a business or it can be invested into the land. So then the question is, so we now know where opportunity zones are, what they are. We now know that the investments made in opportunity zones must be made from capital gains realized within the last 180 days. And then the question then becomes, well, why would anyone do that? And the answer is there are three general incentives: deferral, reduction, and potentially elimination. So if an investment is made in an opportunity zone in the ways I've just described, if it's made and held for 5 years, then the capital gains tax on that amount that was placed into the qualified opportunity fund, the tax for that investor will be reduced by 10%. If it's held for 7 years, that capital gains tax that will be owed will be reduced by a further 5%. So for something to be held for 7 years, results in a reduction of 15% of the capital gains tax that will be owed. Now, it should be noted, the capital gains tax that's owed will come due for all investments on December 31, 2026. So, what does that mean in terms of these incentives? It means that you need to invest prior to December 31, 2019 if you're going to get the full 15% reduction. So, your first incentive is deferral. You don't pay any capital gains tax until December 31, 2026. If you are able to make that investment prior to the end of this year, you potentially could reduce the tax that you're going to have to pay by 15%. But even still, if you're able to make that investment, not by the end of this year, but still within 5 years of 2026, you'll get a reduction of 10%, which when you're talking, you know, millions of dollars in capital gains tax, that's potentially pretty significant. The third incentive is that whatever investment is made into either the business or the lands, if that investment is held for 10 years, then and that investment appreciates, any capital gains realized from that investment will be tax-free, will be capital gains tax-free. So I'm not talking about the amount that the investor placed into the Qualified Opportunity Fund, but the investment that that fund then made into the Opportunity Zone. If that investment is held for 10 years, then it's potentially tax-free. So that's what the program is. So why is this significant for renewables development? Well, two main areas. Number one, location. Many renewables projects are already in opportunity zones, or if there are, let's say, two potential sites that are equally valid, one is outside an opportunity zone and one is within, then the investors might, or the developer rather, may want to consider locating that project within the opportunity zone. Why would they do that? Well, for one reason, if you can draw off of this pool of money that I just described, you are going to lower your cost of capital. That's attractive in its own right. But as I'm sure everyone on the call knows, the investment tax credit is looking, you know, is going to sunset, and unless it's extended, it will start stepping down after the end of this year. So that means that you're going to have fewer and fewer tax equity investors looking to get involved in renewables. And from what I understand, that's already occurring anyway. Another reason why tax equity investors are cooling to renewables is because that same piece of legislation that enabled the Opportunity Zone program also, as everyone knows, significantly reduced the corporate tax rate. So there's less of a return for tax equity investors in general because of the corporate tax rate reduction. And then the ITC will be stepping down over the next couple of years. So there's, you know, one would suspect less interest by tax equity investors to invest in renewables, and those equity investments comprise a significant portion for both wind and solar. So all of that is to say, opportunity zone investors could potentially fill some of that void and create a new pool of equity to be invested into renewables. Now, having said that, I want to be clear that a project that doesn't pencil because you know, it's the interconnection's too far away, or, you know, there's too many upgrades that need to be built, or for whatever reason, if that project doesn't make, if that project is located in an opportunity zone and it doesn't make sense, well, let me put it this way. If that project doesn't make sense, trying to do it in an opportunity zone is not going to suddenly make that project profitable or make sense. However, if the a project already pencils and you have a choice between locating it on one side of the street where it's outside an opportunity zone or on the other side of the street where it's inside an opportunity zone, then it may be worthwhile to do it within the opportunity zone for all the reasons I just said. But again, a bad project doesn't suddenly become good because of the opportunity zone program, but a good project may become even better by locating it within an opportunity zone. So I realize there's a lot of information in a short period of time, so I'm going to step back and allow others to chime in.
All right. Rick, do you have anything to add to that? The comments?
Yeah, I don't really have a deep background on opportunity zones. My main, and so, and everything that has been shared is consistent with what I've learned in the process of actually developing a project that's located in an opportunity zone. So I really don't have, you know, background information that would add anything there. I was just going to, you know, have if people are interested, talk about some of the ups and downs and ins and outs of, you know, securing financing from investors who are interested in monetizing the opportunity zone benefits. So, I mean, I can do that now, or we can have it as part of the discussion, however you want to do it.
You can go ahead. And or Michael, do you have something to comment on this? And then we can, maybe we can just open it up. Michael, do
no,
you want to talk?
No, I appreciate Patrick doing the intro, because that was a pretty good overview. So thank you for that.
Yeah, so I mean, I'll just give this case example real quick just to kind of give some flavor to this. We were approached by a nonprofit organization that had secured an option on a property that it was located in an opportunity zone in a low-income area in general. And their interest was in developing that project as a community solar project, both as a way of offering lower cost energy to local residents and businesses in this community that was also clean, as well as a workforce training opportunity for them. They do they have weatherization and small residential solar job training type activities. And this was an opportunity for them to do a larger scale project. This project was more like a four megawatt DC project. And as a developer of the project, there's an opportunity to generate some income ongoing by providing ongoing operations and maintenance services to the project. But they weren't in a position where they had any financing of their own, but decided to go forward with it. And we then went out and, you know, we did the technical work of identifying, you know, what the potential performance or production could come from a project in this particular location, what the interconnection issues would be from an engineering standpoint, whether there were any environmental issues, you know, all the various due diligence things you have to do to see whether a project is viable. And all those things worked out quite well. The issue that, you know, that we've been working on with them most recently is securing some financing. And part of that would be finding a entity that was interested in monetizing both the ITC and opportunity zone benefits. The interesting piece was that even with a fairly aggressive assumption about construction costs, EPC costs, even with, you know, we found one impact investor, somebody who has a sustainable investing orientation. We have gotten to a place where we've offered to the local utility who we have to partner with in order to do this project a fairly attractive PPA rate. But even so, even with the attractive PPA rate, financing being very, very low cost, we're still in a bit of a struggle with the local utility around, are they prepared to, you know, to enter into a contract, 20-year contract for this power? Because their sort of orientation attitude is, you know, we can buy that power wholesale and a 100 megawatt, 200 megawatt project down in the desert at a cost that's, you know, significantly less than what this PPA rate that we're offering to them for this community solar project. So we're in the process of, you know, pushing back and forth, negotiating that. Without the opportunity zone benefit, I don't think we could have gotten the financing costs as low as we've been able to. But even there, it's not a slam dunk. So stay tuned. We'll see how that plays out.
All right.
This is Michael.
Other folks here. Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
So in Chattanooga, you know, we're not quite as far ahead as that of actually putting a fund together. What we do have is we've got a consultant that we're working with who's been doing research and development on opportunity zones and has been sort of leading the effort to basically work with people in the development space in Chattanooga. They actually put a project on our radar that's in Chicago. So 548 Capital is putting together a $100 million fund that is focused on solar-powered affordable housing. And so one of the things that I think Patrick mentioned, that if you're putting this money into real estate, you have to basically double the cost basis. And so you have to make substantial improvement to the property. Now, there's also a play that you can do in business development. So you can invest in a business in an opportunity zone, but there's been much less sort of concrete opportunities that have, at least we've seen in, on that side of it. Most of it's been focused on this real estate piece. But as I'm sure everybody on this call knows, you know, one great way to invest money in real property is through efficiency and renewable energy. And so this particular fund in Chicago has already raised $2 million. They've, I think, soft-circled like $20 million, and then are in the process of trying to raise the rest of the $80 million. But they're planning on basically purchasing 3,300 units and maintaining affordability in those units, putting their investment in efficiency, and then rather than providing the returns to the fund from rent, they're planning on using the solar revenue to provide the returns to the fund so that they can maintain affordable rent. We really like this model, and we would really love to replicate that in Chattanooga, and so we're just at the very beginning of that process to figure out how we might do that.
Anybody else? We have a couple other folks on the call here who might want to chime in. Tony, do you want to add anything, or Jeff?
Hi, this is Tony. I just thank you for your presentation. And when this first came out, it sounded pretty good for renewable energy. And then when we talked with our tax accountant, he said we'd have to meet three thresholds for it to be useful. One, obviously, that the investor has capital gains, but also that the investor has to have passive income in order to qualify for any tax benefits, not just the ITC, but also the bonus depreciation. And third, that the project would have to appreciate in value over the 10 years. And typically, because of depreciation, renewable energy projects tend to depreciate. So I wondered, our accountant suggested that there might be some investors that have current capital gains that they want to reduce, but that it was kind of a 1 in 10,000 possibility as far as making it pencil for those investors. I wondered if you had a similar sense of optimism about it.
Anybody? Patrick?
Well, I think Tony hit the nail on the head with respect to a renewables-only project. These assets, you know, depreciate and often rapidly over time. So after 10 years, you're not looking for a big payout. But I think Michael's case study of 548 Capital is very interesting, where if the renewables are paired with a real estate development, then, and the opportunity zone investor then wants to cash out after 10 years, then maybe there is an opportunity to see that type of return. But I think in general, Tony's right, and be interested to hear what the others have to say.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I mean, this is Michael again. I think that's what made that particular case study attractive, is that it does, you know, the solar itself begins to provide the passive income to provide the returns, but then the assets that are purchased are the ones that you're actually, you know, building value in.
Jeff, do you have anything to contribute to this? And one other thing too, Tony, why don't you tell us what you do? Let's do that before Jeff talks. Tell us a little bit about what your work is all about.
Besides asking impertinent questions, we're a solar development company in Virginia and a B Corp certified, the first B Corp certified solar company in Virginia, because we do so much work in helping to peel back the barriers to solar at the policy level with legislation. We were the first mover in Virginia in developing and implementing power purchase agreements. And a lot of our work is with tax-exempt entities like public school districts, hospitals, universities, and churches. And finding tax equity capital has been one of the big challenges, not just for us, but for anyone who's trying to develop solar, particularly because investors have to be able to have passive income in order to qualify for the tax benefits. So that's where folks who invest in real estate may make good candidates, and potentially those same folks would have capital gains. So I think my thought on this is that that would be the target market for this opportunity zone. Andrew, do you want to add to some of the work we do with Secure Futures in terms of how we innovate?
Tony, why don't you, or Andrew, why don't you talk a little bit about your work around on the PPA over there in Virginia?
Yeah, so here in Virginia, power purchase agreements were not legal until 2013. When Tony and work with a number of other policy groups to help get a pilot program through with Dominion Energy for 50 megawatts of distributed solar generation in Dominion territory. And so now we're seeing that pilot program being met by the end of this year,
So on one hand, it's been really exciting that we've been able to help get policy through to expand solar opportunities, but now we have to, it's a continuous battle to keep expanding opportunities, because now we have to go back and renegotiate to get more of that cap expanded so that solar can keep growing. We've also been kind of on the forefront finding innovative ways to get around some of those barriers through service agreements and other ways of structuring deals so that entities that are in, you know, non-Dominion territory that don't allow PPAs, we can still do solar with them. And so, yeah, it's been a continuous challenge to overcome some of these barriers. But, you know, as the market keeps opening up, we're seeing a quick expansion. And we foresee this to continue happening here in Virginia and in other surrounding states as well.
Okay, Jeff, do you have anything to contribute to the conversation?
No, yeah, nothing I would say significant. I mean, I just kind of, we, you know, kind of looked a little bit at the idea of opportunity zones and, you know, using that as a part of our investment stack. And I think, you know, part of the complication there that comes as well is that the locations are, if you will, designated, or there's only a certain number of areas you can do this in. And so it sort of restricts what in many ways is an already complicated process of locating properties, and be it land or buildings to, you know, if you will, invest in or install systems on and stuff like that. So it's been sort of in our, you know, big picture radar screen, but we haven't done anything actively in that area yet. So, you know, it's something of interest, but, you know, I think partially because the fuse is so short on it, to really, you know, capitalize on it. I'm guessing we're not going to aggressively go after much there.
Okay. All right, anybody else here? Go ahead and dive in. Patrick?
This is Michael. I think one thing to note is, again, I think Patrick touched on this, but, you know, what we're seeing with these the opportunity zone funds is that they're really just a piece of a capital stack in general to make projects work. And so, you know, as a few people have mentioned, it's not going to make a project pencil. And, you know, I think it's certainly, like, nobody that's listening to this should sort of see this as any sort of like silver bullet. I mean, it's great to pair with other incentives like new market tax credits and, you know, other state and federal incentives as part of a larger capital stack. So we're not seeing a lot of people that are like, you know, that this isn't driving specific projects.
Any comments?
This is Patrick. Yeah, I obviously agree with Michael, and that was the point I was making. And I think he or someone else raised the question of, you know, when you're dealing with investment in the business as opposed to the real estate, it's less clear what you need to do to make sure that you continue to qualify under the Opportunity Zone program rules. Because real estate, the rule is you essentially need to double the value of the land within 31 months, and you've met the requirements. But the business is, it's less clear. And one of the questions that was brought to my attention by a developer who, I think this is probably more likely the case than not for developers, is they're working on a project, someone brings to their attention, hey, by the way, you're in an opportunity zone, as opposed to, I mean, Jeff was just saying like, well, it's, you know, it's not something like we're actively seeking projects solely within opportunity zones. And one of the issues that arises is, well, these projects cover a lot of land. And so there's a good likelihood that some of the project is within the opportunity zone and some of it is outside of the opportunity zone. And how do you figure out whether that project will qualify in its entirety for the opportunity zone program? And there are tests that have been issued in the last set of regs. There's been two sets of opportunity zone regulations that have been issued by Treasury, and they give you some guidance, but there's still some uncertainty when the investment is in the business itself. And I think that's also probably keeping some money on the sideline as well, is just that little bit of uncertainty.
Anybody else? Rick?
I wish I could add some more here. I mean, I'm in the situation where, similar to what people have talked about, if a project is located in an opportunity zone, then we kind of, that just, you know, adds benefit, potential benefit, when we go out and, you know, try to secure a PPA agreement on behalf of our public sector customers to see, you know, if that can help ultimately, you know, the bottom line for those customers at, in terms of the PPA rate. But we don't necessarily look to find projects based on those locations. There's so many variables associated with project qualification, particularly for public entities, that, you know, and they have the locations they have. So we're not in the business of, you know, just opportunistically going out. We work with the clients and the customers we have based on, you know, what their needs are. And we do a lot of work in low income areas. And we actually have a project right now where we got a grant from the California Energy Commission to develop some battery and solar plus battery and microgrids that happen to be located in, in opportunity zones, or actually some of the sites, the school district, and four of the sites are in opportunity zones, six of them aren't. In the negotiations with our PPA provider, we're making sure they're, you know, doing the granular enough analysis between the different project sites that, you know, our client is getting that benefit, but it's not something where we, like I said, where we target. It's more, like I said, opportunistic.
Okay. Anybody else? Tony, do you want to talk a little bit about some of your creative workarounds that Andrew alluded to?
Andrew, do you want to start? We may have stepped away. Just because of the opposition from utilities to power purchase agreements, we developed a self-generation agreement, which looks and talks a lot like a PPA, except that it doesn't entail the sale of electricity, which is what utilities object to. So a self-generation agreement entails the sale of services, which include financing, installing, owning and operating, and maintaining a solar array, and the customer generates or self-generates the electricity. So we're not involved in any way in selling electricity or output. We're compensated based on a service, and the performance is based to maintaining the system at manufacturer specifications. So we've succeeded in getting this type of agreement approved and implemented in other utility service areas throughout Virginia, and we now have an application pending with the North Carolina Utility Commission to have it approved as a form of lease agreement in North Carolina so that tax-exempt entities like universities and hospitals can benefit from the tax benefits of solar, which they couldn't otherwise do under a lease. So the odd thing in North Carolina is that it's being certified as an approved type of energy generation lease, even though in no way, shape, or form is it actually a lease from the standpoint of Treasury rules. Other work that we've done to reduce costs for customers is to organize solar barnstorming events, typically with small customers. Like we've done 100 kilowatts here and 60 kilowatts there using volunteers who do a lot of the manual labor involved with solar and are able to install these systems in a day with volunteers. And then we usually arrange for the electrical work to follow, but it significantly reduces the cost of doing solar using volunteers that are organized by the host customer. So I guess in the area of trying to finance projects or structure them, we've been forced by challenges in the regulatory environment and economic environment to seek creative ways with our customers to innovate in order to continue to make solar affordable. It creates an endless source of joy for us in trying to continuously innovate. And we're finding that very often we have to innovate not just once a year or every couple of years, but typically every 6 months or less in terms of our business model. And that was in part why we were interested in this discussion on opportunity zones. We would love to find a situation where that could work, but it's since we're not in the business of specifically seeking out projects in opportunity zones, although many of them are, it's finding those investors who have that combination of passive income and capital gains that makes it a little challenging for us. And I'd welcome any suggestions on how to find folks that meet both those criteria.
Well, this is Patrick, and I'm glad you just raised that question, Tony, because I feel like perhaps I or we have thrown too much of a wet blanket across this opportunity zone idea, and I just wanted to put out there and somewhat of a self-serving plug, but my firm alone has closed 19 deals for either opportunity funds or investments in businesses in opportunity zones. I think we have another 16 deals that are currently being negotiated and something like over 40 active discussions with people who are, these are real conversations that are being had, not just, you know, inquiry telephone calls. So there is a lot happening there. And for anyone on this call who is looking to make that sort of connection with, you know, a potential fund, I'm happy to utilize the resources that I have at my disposal, which is mostly my colleagues in my firm who are doing these deals, to see, you know, if there is a connection that can be made that meets the criteria that Tony just described. So I just want to make a point that there is a lot happening in the opportunity zone space with respect to renewables. I think Rick and Michael and Jeff and, you know, have all pointed out where the complications arise when trying to do that. And I think, you know, each of us has said something that's, you know, consistent with either experience or just analysis of Opportunity Zone funding as adding to the capital stack. But that doesn't mean it's impossible, and I think it is worth pursuing. And like I said, I'm happy to make whatever connections I can to facilitate that.
Well, as a possible project, we're actually working with a nonprofit in Richmond that is located in an opportunity zone. Is that, and we're proposing to put in a, I don't recall if Andrew's on the call, he could probably remind me the size of the system. I think it's 240 kilowatts. Is that the sort of project where you could potentially help us find potential investors that would meet those criteria?
It's possible. I can't tell you off the top of my head, but it's certainly worth having a conversation, obviously, offline from this call.
Mm-hmm. Sierra, can you do an intro email to both of us?
I sure can. Be happy to.
That'll be great. Thank you. And this was Richard speaking?
No, this is Patrick.
Oh, Patrick, I'm sorry. Okay, with Dwayne Morris?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I think I see your email from Sarah's invitation. Okay.
Yes, you should have it on the invitations that I sent out. Any other thoughts here? Okay. Well, we can go ahead and end the call if nobody else has anything else to contribute to the conversation. But I would like to say that we're going to cancel tomorrow's webinar. Patrick was not feeling well, and we just couldn't quite put it together. But on Thursday, we have a call on solar saturation microgrid approach, distributed rooftop solar on existing utility feeder, achieving saturation levels of deployments far in excess of typical hosting capacity limitations. And Shalom Plank will be on that one. It's always worthwhile to hear what Shalom has to say. So hopefully you can join that. And Jeff, I think you're going to be on that as well.
That's the plan.
Okay, and John Walter should be there, also a developer from California. I wish he were on this call, too. I think it would have been of interest to him. So anyhow, thanks so much for attending. I'm sure nobody else has any comments. One more time here. Oh, okay, and do you have then Patrick's number, I take it, or his information, Tony, from the sheet I sent out. Is that correct?
Yes, I have it. Patrick, I'll send you an email intro.
Okay,
good.
Super.
Great.
All right. Thanks now.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody, for coming, and yet again, good conversations.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.